fingers on his desk. He picked up one of the pictures and flipped it over to the side with writing on it. "This story, where is the rest of it?" I imagined the guards ransacking the block, trying to find more photographs with writing. When they didn't, would they just start hurting people until someone gave them the answer they wanted? "I haven't written it yet," I confessed. This surprised him. I realized he had assumed I was simply recounting a tale I'd read elsewhere. I wasn't supposed to be intelligent enough to create something like this. "You," he said, "you made up this monster, this upur?" "Yes," I answered. "Well, I mean, no. In Poland, everyone knows about the upur. But this particular one, he is a figment of my imagination."
"Most girls write of love.
You choose to write about a beast," he said thoughtfully. We were speaking in German. We were having a conversation about writing. As if at any moment he might not take out his pistol and shoot me in the head.
"Your choice of topic reminds me of another mythical beast," he said. "The Donestre. You have heard of it?"
Was this a test? A trick? Was it a euphemism for some kind of corporal punishment? Was my treatment dependent on my answer? I knew of Vodnik, water demon, and Dziwożona, dryads, but they were Polish legends. What if I lied and said yes? Would I be worse off than if I told the truth and said no?
"The ancient Greeks, which is what I studied in school, wrote of the Donestre. It had the head of a lion and the body of a man. It could speak all the languages of the human race, which, as you might imagine," the Hauptscharführer said dryly, "came in handy."
I looked into my lap. I wondered what he would think if he knew my nickname for him, Herr Dibuk, referred to yet another mythical beast.
"Like your upur, this brute killed freely and devoured its prey. But the Donestre had one particular trait. It would save the severed head of its victim, sit beside it, and weep."
He fixed his gaze on me until I glanced up.
"Why do you think that was?"
I swallowed. I had never heard of this Donestre, but I knew the upur Alexander better than I knew myself. I had lived, breathed, birthed that character. "Perhaps some monsters," I said quietly, "still have a conscience." The officer's nostrils flared. He stood up and came around the desk, and I immediately cowered, throwing up my arm to block the blow. "You realize," he said, his voice practically a whisper, "for stealing, I could make an example of you, publicly flog you, like the prisoner the Schutzhaftlagerführer was punishing earlier. Or kill you." Tears sprang to my eyes. As it turned out, I was not too proud to plead for my meager life. "Please don't. I'll do anything."
The Hauptscharführer hesitated.
"Then tell me," he said, "what happens next?" To say I was stunned would be an understatement. Not only did the Hauptscharführer not lay a hand on me, but he kept me in his office for the rest of the day, typing out lists of all the items that had been salvaged in Canada. These, I would learn, were sent to various places around Europe that were still controlled by the Germans, along with the goods themselves. This, he told me, was my new assignment. I would take dictation, type letters, answer the phone, in German, of course, and take messages for him. When he left to walk through the barracks of Canada, his usual routine, he did not leave me alone. Instead, he had another officer stand guard inside the office to make sure I did not do anything suspicious. The whole time I was typing, my fingers shook on the keys. When the Hauptstaffführer returned, he sat down at his desk without saying a word. He began to punch numbers into an adding machine. Its long white tongue curled over the edge of his desk as he worked his way through a stack of papers. By late afternoon, my head was swimming. Unlike in Canada, I had not been given soup at lunch. However limited that sustenance was, it was still food. When the Hauptstaffführer came back after one of his patrols of Canada with a muffin and a coffee, my stomach growled so loudly that I knew that in our close quarters he could hear it. Shortly afterward there was a knock on the office door, and I jumped in my chair. The Hauptstaffführer called out for the visitor to enter. I kept my eyes trained on the page in front of me, but immediately recognized the voice of the Schutzhaftlagerführer, which sounded like smoke falling over the edge of a blade. "What a pisshole of a day," he said, throwing open the door. "Come, I need to dull my senses at the canteen before I have to suffer through Appell." The hair on the back of my neck prickled. He had to suffer through Appell? His eyes fell on me, head bent, diligently typing.
"Well," he said, "what is this?"
"I needed a secretary, Rainer. I told you that a month ago. The amount of paper that gets processed through this office grows bigger every day."
"And I told you I'd take care of it."
"It was taking you too long. Write me up if it makes you feel better." He shrugged. "I took matters into my own hands."
The Schutzhaftlagerführer walked around me in a half circle.
"By taking one of my workers?"
"One of my workers," the Hauptstaffführer said.
"Without my permission?"
"For God's sake, Rainer, you can find another. This one happens to be fluent in German."
"Wirklich?" he said. "Really?" He was talking to me. But since I had my back to him, I didn't know he was waiting for a response. Suddenly, something crashed down on the back of my skull. I fell out of my chair onto my knees, reeling.
"You will answer when you are spoken to." The Schutzhaftlagerführer stood over me with his hand raised.
Before he could strike me again, his brother took a firm grasp of his arm. "I would request that you trust me to discipline my own staff."
The Schutzhaftlagerführer's eyes glittered. "You would ask this of your superior, Franz?"
"No," the Hauptstaffführer replied. "I would ask this of my brother."
The tension dissipated then, like steam through a window.
"So you've decided to adopt a pet," the Schutzhaftlagerführer laughed.
"You would not be the first officer to do so, although I question your judgment when there are fine Volksdeutsche girls who are ready and willing."
I dragged myself onto the chair again, running my tongue across my teeth to make sure none had been knocked loose. I wondered if this was what the Hauptstaffführer planned for me, if I'd been brought here to be his whore. That was a whole new level of punishment I hadn't considered. I had not yet heard of a female prisoner being sexually abused by an officer. It was not that they were such gentlemen, but relationships were against the rules. and these officers were big on rules. Plus, we were Jews, and therefore completely undesirable. To lie with one of us was to lie with vermin.
"Let's talk about this in the canteen," the Hauptscharführer suggested.
He left the remains of his muffin on his desk. As he passed me, he said,
"You will clean up my desk while I'm gone."
I nodded, looking away. I could feel the Schutzhaftlagerführer's eyes raking over my face, my knobby body hidden beneath the work dress.
"Just remember, Franz," he said, "stray dogs bite."
This time the Hauptscharführer did not have a junior officer babysit me. Instead, he locked me into the office. This trust unnerved me. The interest in my writing, the news that he was making me his secretary, a job that would allow me to be warm all day long, now that winter was coming, and that could not be considered hard labor by any means. Why show me kindness if he planned to rape me? "So, it's not rape." The thought fell like a stone into the well of my mind. "It would never happen. I'd slit my throat with a letter opener before I developed any kind of relationship with an SS officer." I silently sent a thank you to Aaron, who had been my first, so that this German did not have to be. I crossed to his desk. How long had it been since I had a muffin? My father had baked them sometimes, with stone-ground cornmeal and the finest white sugar. This one was dark, with currants caught in the cake. I pressed my fingers to the wax paper, gathering up the crumbs. Half of it I tucked into a little torn corner of the paper and slipped into my dress, saving it for later. I would share it with Daria. Then I licked my fingers clean. The flavor nearly brought me to my knees. I drank the last sips of coffee, too, before carefully putting the paper into the trash and drying the cup. Immediately, I began to panic. What if this was not a show of trust, but another test? What if he came back and checked the garbage can to see if I had stolen his food? I played out the scenarios in my mind. The two brothers would enter, and the Schutzhaftlagerführer would say, "I told you so, Franz," and then the Hauptscharführer would shrug and turn me over to his brother for the whipping I had been expecting this morning. If stealing photographs from the dead was bad, surely taking food that belonged to an officer was much worse. By the time the Hauptscharführer unlocked the office door and entered again, alone, I was so nervous that my teeth were chattering. He frowned at me.
"You are cold?"
I could smell beer on his breath. I nodded, although I had not been this warm for weeks. He did not look in the trash. He glanced around the room cursorily, then sat down on the corner of his desk and picked up the stack of photographs.
"I must confiscate these. You understand?"
"Yes," I whispered. It took me a moment to realize that he was holding something out to me. A small leather journal and a fountain pen.
"You will take these instead."
Hesitantly, I took the gifts. The pen was heavy in my hand. It was all I could do to not hold the journal up to my nose, breathe in the scent of the paper and the hide.
"This arrangement," he said formally, "it suits you."
As if I had a choice. Was I willing to trade my body in order to feed my mind? Because that was the deal he was striking, or so his brother had said. For a price, I could write all I wanted, and I would be assigned to a job anyone else would have killed for. When I did not answer, he sighed and stood.
Come, he said.
I started shaking again, so violently that he stepped away from me. It was time for me to pay up. I crossed my arms, hugging the journal to my chest, wondering where he would take me.
To officers' quarters, I supposed.
I could do this. I would go somewhere else in my mind. I would close my eyes and I would think of Anya and Alexander and a world I could control. Just as my story had calmed Daria, just as it had soothed the others in my block, I would use it to numb myself. I clenched my teeth as we walked outside. Although it was no longer raining, there were massive mud puddles. The Hauptscharführer strode right through them in his heavy boots as I struggled to keep up, but instead of turning toward the other side of the camp where the officers lived, he led me to the entrance to my block. The women had already come back from work and were waiting for Appell. The Hauptscharführer called for the Blockälteste, who immediately began to ingratiate herself. "This prisoner will now be working for me," he announced. "This book and pen she holds are my possessions. Should they go missing, you will personally answer to me and to the Schutzhaftlagerführer. Is that clear?" The beast nodded, mute. Behind her there was a buzz of silence. The curiosity of the other women was palpable.
Then the Hauptscharführer turned to me. "By tomorrow, 10 more pages."
And then, instead of taking me to his quarters and raping me, he left. The beast immediately sneered.
"He may be protecting you now, but when he gets tired of what's between your legs, he'll find someone else."
I pushed past her to where Daria was waiting.
"What did he do to you?" she asked, grabbing onto my forearms. "I've been worried sick all day."
I sank down, taking in everything that happened, the strangest turn of events.
"He did absolutely nothing," I told her. "No punishment. If anything, I got a promotion, because I can speak German. I'm working for an officer who recites poetry and who asked for more of my Upjur story."
Daria's brow furrowed.
"What does he want?"
"I don't know," I answered, amazed. "He didn't touch me. And look."
I took the muffin crumbs from where they were tucked in the waistband of my dress and let her have them.
"He saved this for me."
"He gave you food?"
Daria gasped.
"Well, not exactly, but he left it behind."
Daria tasted the muffin. Her eyes drifted shut, pure rapture. But a moment later she fixed her gaze on me.
"You can put a pig in a ball gown, Minka. That doesn't make it a debutante."
The next morning, after Appell, I presented myself at the Hauptscharführer's office. He was not there, but a junior officer, who was waiting, unlocked the door for me so that I could go inside. I realized that he was probably at Kanada, patrolling the barracks where Daria and the others worked. There was a stack of forms to be typed on my makeshift desk beside the typewriter. Hanging on the back of the chair was a woman's cardigan sweater. This is how my routine settled. Every morning I would report to the Hauptscharführer's office. There would be work waiting for me while he made his rounds in Kanada. At midday, the Hauptscharführer brought lunch from the main camp back to his office. Often he got a second ration of soup or a slice of bread. Yet he never finished either. Instead, he would leave these in the trash when he left the office, knowing full well I would eat them. Every day as he ate his lunch, I would read aloud what I had written the night before. And then he would ask me questions. Does Anya know that Damien is trying to frame Alexander? Will we ever see Casimir committing murder? But most of his questions were about Alexander. Is the love you feel for a brother different from the love you feel for a woman? Would you sacrifice one for the other? What must it cost Alex to hide who he really is in order to save Anya? I could not admit this even to Daria, but I began to look forward to going to work, in particular to lunchtime. It was as if the camp fell away while I was reading to the Hauptstaffführer. He listened so carefully that it made me forget that outside there were guards abusing prisoners, and people being gassed to death, and men pulling their bodies from the shower rooms to stack like wood in the crematoria. When I was reading my own work, I got lost in the story, and I could have been anywhere, back in my bedroom in Łódź, scribbling down ideas in the hallway outside Herr Bauer's classroom, sharing a hot cocoa at a café with Daria, curled in the window seat at my father's bakery. I was not stupid enough to presume that the officer and I were equals, but during those moments I felt at least as if my voice still mattered. One day, the Hauptstaffführer tilted back his chair and propped his boots on his desk as I read to him. I had reached a cliffhanger, the moment where Anya enters the dank cave looking for Alexander and instead finds his brutal brother. My voice shook as I described her navigating her way in the darkness, her boots crunching on the hard-backed shells of beetles and the tails of rats.
A torch flickered on the damp walls of the cave.
He frowned. Torches don't flicker. Firelight does. And even so, that's too cliched. I looked up at him. I never quite knew what to say when he criticized my writing like this. Was I supposed to defend myself? Or was that presuming that I had any say in this strange partnership? Firelight dances like a ballerina, the Hauptstaffführer said. It hovers like a ghost. You see? I nodded, making a note in the margin of the book. Go on, he commanded.
There was a sudden draft, and the torch illuminating my path was extinguished. I stood shivering in the dark, unable to see even a foot in front of myself. Then I heard a rustle, a movement. I spun around. Alexander, I whispered. Is that you?
I looked up to find the Hauptstaffführer hanging on my words.
In the dark, there was a soft growl, almost a purr. The rasp of a match, a scent of sulfur. The torch blazed to life again. Crouched before me in a pool of blood was a man with wild eyes and knotted hair. More blood dripped from his mouth and covered his hands, which held a haunch of meat. I fell back, struggling to find air. That haunch of meat he was devouring had a hand, fingers. They were still clutching the top of a gilded cane I couldn't have forgotten if I tried. Baruch Beiler was no longer missing.
There was a knock at the door. A junior officer stuck his head inside. Herr Hauptstaffführer, he said, it is already 2 o'clock. I snapped the book shut and began to roll a new form into my typewriter. I am fully capable of telling time, the Hauptstaffführer called out. It will be time to go when I say it is time to go. He waited for the door to close. You will not start typing yet, he said. Continue. I nodded, fumbling with the leather journal again and clearing my throat.
I felt my vision fading, my head spinning. It wasn't a wild animal, I forced out. It was you. The cannibal smiled, his teeth slick and stained crimson. Wild animal.
pure.
Why split hairs?
The Hauptscharführer laughed.
You killed Baruch Beiler. Hypocrite! Can you honestly say you didn't wish him dead? I considered all the times the man had come to the cottage, demanding tax money we didn't have, extorting deals from my father that only dragged us deeper and deeper into debt. I looked at this beast and suddenly felt like I was going to be sick. My father, I whispered. You killed him, too? When the Upur didn't answer, I flew at him, using my nails and my fury as weapons. I raked at his flesh and kicked and swung. Either I would avenge my father's death or I would die trying.
I continued describing the arrival of Alex, the torture of Anya, as she tried to reconcile the man she was falling in love with a man whose brother was a beast. And what, after all, did that make him? I spoke of her frantic flight from the cave, of Alex chasing after her, of her accusation that he'd had the power to keep her father from being murdered, and didn't.
Your father is not the only person to ever love you,
I read.
And you cannot blame Casimir for his death. He turned away so that his face was in shadow, because I am the one who killed him.
When I finished, my final words remained trapped in the office like the smoke of a rich man's cigar, redolent and sharp. The Hauptscharführer clapped. Slowly. Twice. And then with sustained fervor. Brava, he said. I did not see that coming. I blushed. Thank you. Folding the journal closed again, I sat with my hands in my lap, waiting to be dismissed. But instead, the Hauptscharführer leaned forward. Tell me more about him, he said. Alexander. But I've read you all I have written up to this point. Yes, but you know more than you've written. Was he born a murderer? That's not how it works with an Upur. You have to be the victim of an unnatural death. And yet, the Hauptscharführer pointed out, both Alexander and Casimir suffered the same unfortunate fate. Coincidence? Or just bad luck? He was talking about my characters as if they were real, which, to me, they were. Casimir died while avenging Alexander's murder, I said, which is why Alex feels the need to protect him now. And since Casimir is the younger Upur, he is not yet able to control his appetite the way Alexander can. So, in theory, both of these men had normal childhoods. They had parents who loved them and who took them to church and celebrated their birthdays. They went to school. They worked as paperboys or laborers or artists. And then, one day, due to circumstances, they awakened with a terrible thirst for blood. That's what the legends say. But you are the writer. You can say anything, he pointed out. Look at Anya. In that one moment she was ready to kill the man she believed had murdered her father. And yet she is painted as a heroine. I had not thought about this, but it was true. There was no black and white. Someone who had been good her entire life could, in fact, do something evil. Anya was just as capable of committing murder, under the right circumstances, as any monster. Was there something in their upbringing, in their history, in their genetics, that made them the way they are now? The Hauptscharführer asked. Some fatal, hidden flaw. Surely there are plenty of men who die and who don't suffer the fate of being reborn as an Upur.
I don't know, I admitted. Maybe it's the fact that Alexander doesn't want to be an Upur that makes him different.
You mean a monster with remorse? The Hauptschafuhrer mused.
Then he stood and took his heavy wool coat from its hanger. On his desk was a second ration of soup he had not touched.
Tomorrow, he announced, 10 more pages.
He stepped out of the office, locking the door behind himself. I carefully tied the leather journal again with the ribbon that circled it and set it beside my typewriter. I crossed to the desk and picked up the soup. Suddenly, I heard the lock turn in the door. I dropped the soup, spilling it on the hardwood beneath the desk. The Hauptschauführer was standing there, waiting for me to turn to him. I trembled, wondering what he would say when he saw the puddle at my feet. But he did not seem to notice.
What do you think it was like the first time Alexander bled one of his victims? He asked. Do you think even then he felt shame, disgust?
I shook my head. He couldn't help himself.
Does that make it any less detestable?
For the victim, I asked, or for the Upur? The officer stared at me, his eyes narrowed.
Is there a difference?
I did not answer. Moments later, when the key turned again in the lock, I got down on my hands and knees and lapped up what I could from the floor.
One morning after a storm, when the snow had blanketed the camp, Daria and I stepped outside the block to march to work. We shuffled behind other women, all wrapped in ragged layers, freezing. The path, which we took every day, marched us along the far side of the fence at the entrance ramp to the camp. Sometimes we would see the new railroad cars arriving. Sometimes there was a selection going on as we passed. Sometimes we shuffled past a line of people waiting for the shower they would not survive. That day, as we passed, a new group of prisoners was being belched out of one of the cars. They stood like we had, on the platform, carrying their belongings, yelling out names of loved ones. Suddenly, we saw her. She was dressed from head to toe in white silk. On her head, a veil streamed out behind her in the cold wind. She was looking around, even as she was herded into line for the selection. The rest of us women all stopped, riveted by this sight. It was, unbelievably, not the most depressing thing we had ever seen. A bride, ripped from her own wedding, separated from her groom, and put on a transport to Auschwitz. On the contrary, it gave us hope. It meant that no matter what was happening in this camp, no matter how many Jews they managed to round up and kill, there were still more of us out there. Living lives, falling in love, getting married, assuming that tomorrow would come.
The main camp of Auschwitz was a village. There was a grocer, a canteen, a cinema, and a theater hall that showcased opera singers and musicians, some of whom were Jews. There was a photography darkroom and a soccer stadium. There was a sporting club that the officers could join, and there were matches. Prisoners who had been boxers, for example, pitted against each other while the officers bet on them. There was alcohol, too. The officers were given rations, but from what I saw, occasionally they pooled them to get drunk together. I knew all this because as the weeks went by, the Hauptscharführer would occasionally send me on an errand for him. I was to pick up cigarettes one day, laundry the next. I became his Läuferin, a runner, who would carry messages whenever necessary. He would send me to Canada from time to time to deliver notes to the junior officers who patrolled when he was in his office. As the winter came and the temperatures dropped, I would throw caution to the wind and do what I could for Daria and the others. When the Hauptscharführer left to go to the officers' club for a meal or across the camp for a meeting, and I knew he would be gone for an extended length of time, I would type up a note on his letterhead requesting that prisoner A18557, Daria, be brought in for questioning. Daria and I would hurry back to the office, where for at least a half hour she could warm herself before having to go back to work in the freezing barracks of Canada. There were others like me, privileged prisoners. We would nod to each other as we passed in the village doing our jobs. We walked the finest of lines. People hated us because we had it easy, but they valued us because we were able to steal things that made their lives better. Food they could eat, cigarettes and whiskey they could use to bribe the guards. For a bottle of vodka that Daria took from a suitcase in Canada, I was able to trade a rind from a squash and some lamp oil from a prisoner working in the officers' club. We hollowed out 8 thumbprints in the rind, added a wick made of yarn from a sweater, and in this way made candles to celebrate Hanukkah. There was a rumor that a Jewish secretary who worked for an officer elsewhere in the camp had managed to swap a pair of reading glasses for a kitten, which was still inexplicably alive in the block where she lived. We were considered untouchable because of our protectors. Some SS man who, for whatever reason, had found us useful. For some, I imagined, that was because of sex. But as the weeks rolled into months, the Hauptscharführer still did not lay a hand on me, in anger or in lust. All he wanted, really, was my story. From time to time he would casually mention something about himself, which was interesting because I had forgotten that we prisoners were not the only ones who had a life before this one. He had wanted to study at Heidelberg, classics. He had hoped to be a poet himself, or if not the editor of a literary journal. He had been writing a thesis on the Iliad when he was compelled to fight for his country. He did not like his brother very much. I knew this from their interactions. Whenever the Schutzhaftlagerführer dropped in to speak with him, I found myself huddling smaller in my chair, as if I could make myself disappear. He did not notice me most of the time. I was that insignificant to him. The Schutzhaftlagerführer drank a lot, and when he did, he got angry. I had seen this, of course, at Appell, but sometimes the Hauptscharführer would receive a phone call, and he would have to go to the village to bring his brother back to the officers' quarters. The next day, the Schutzhaftlagerführer would come to the office. He would say that the nightmares were what made him do it, that he had to drink to forget what he'd seen in the field. It was as close as he could get to an apology, I supposed. But then, as if this very contrition was distasteful, he would start raging again. The Schutzhaftlagerführer would say that he was the head of the women's camp, and that everyone answered to him.
Sometimes, to punctuate this, he would sweep his hand across all the papers on the desk, or knock over the coat rack, or throw the adding machine across the room. I wondered if the other officers knew that the two men were related. If, like me, they wondered how two such different individuals might have emerged from the same womb. One of the other perks of my job was knowing when the Schutzhaftlagerführer was likely to be on an angry tear, since these tears followed his bouts of private contrition like clockwork. I was not stupid. I knew that what the Hauptscharführer saw in my book was not simply entertainment, but an allegory, a way to understand the complicated relationship between himself and his brother, between his past and his present, his conscience and his actions. If one brother was a monster, did it follow that the other had to be one too? One day, the Hauptscharführer had dispatched me to the village to pick up a bottle of aspirin from the pharmacy. It was snowing hard, and the drifts were so deep that my feet in their wooden clogs were soaked. I wore the coat I had been given, and a pink wool cap and mittens that Daria had stolen from Canada for me as a Hanukkah gift. The trip, which usually took only 10 minutes, was twice as long due to the howling wind and the spitting ice. I picked up the parcel and was headed back to the Hauptscharführer's office, when suddenly the door of the canteen burst open, and the Schutzhaftlagerführer flew through it, pounding the face of a junior officer. Believe it or not, there were rules at Auschwitz. An officer could beat any prisoner for no more reason than that the prisoner looked at him funny. But he could not kill without reason, because that meant eliminating a worker from the great cog that was this camp. He could treat a prisoner like pond scum, and could abuse a Ukrainian guard or a Jewish capo, but he was not allowed to show disrespect to another SS man. The Schutzhaftlagerführer was clearly important, but there had to be someone more important than him who would get word of this. I started to run. I raced across the camp, slipping on patches of ice, my cheeks and nose numbed by the cold, until I reached the administration building where the Hauptscharführer's office was. It was empty. I hurried outside again, this time to the barracks of Canada. I found the Hauptscharführer talking to several of the guards, pointing out an inaccuracy in their reporting. "Excuse me, Herr Hauptscharführer," I murmured as my pulse raced uncontrollably. "May we speak privately?" "I am busy," he said. I nodded, moving away. If I said nothing, no one would ever know what I had witnessed. If I said nothing, the Schutzhaftlagerführer would be reprimanded, maybe even demoted or transferred, which would certainly be a good thing for all of us. Well, maybe not for his brother. I don't know what was more viscerally shocking to me, the fact that I turned around and marched back into the sorting barracks, or the realization that I cared about the Hauptscharführer's welfare. "I am sorry, Herr Hauptscharführer," I murmured, "but this is a matter of grave importance." He dismissed the officers and dragged me outside by the arm. The wind and snow howled around us. "You do not interrupt me in my work, is that clear?" I nodded. "Perhaps I have given you the wrong impression. I am the one who orders you around, not vice versa. I will not have officers beneath me thinking that I..."
"The Schutzhaftlagerführer," I interrupted. "He is in a brawl outside the canteen."
The blood drained from the Hauptscharführer's face. He started to walk briskly in the direction of the camp village, breaking into a run as he turned the corner. My fingers flexed on the bottle of aspirin still tucked inside my pink mitten. I walked back to the administration building and let myself into the office. I took off my coat and my hat and mittens and set them to dry on the radiator. Then I sat down and began to type. I worked through lunch. This time there was no reading. There was no extra ration for me. It was not until twilight that the Hauptscharführer returned. He dusted the snow off his coat and hung it up with his officer's cap, then dropped down heavily behind his desk, steepling his hands together. "Do you have a sibling?" he asked. I faced him. "I did." The Hauptscharführer met my gaze and nodded. He scribbled a message on a piece of stationery and folded it into an envelope. "Take this to the Commandant's office," he said, and I blenched. I had never been there before, although I knew where it was. "Explain that the Schutzhaftlagerführer is indisposed with illness and will not be present at Appell." I nodded. I pulled on my coat, still wet, and my mittens and my hat. "Wait!" The Hauptscharführer's voice called me back as I started to turn the doorknob. "I do not know your name."
I had been working for him now for 12 weeks. "Minka," I murmured.
"Minka."
He looked down at the papers on his desk, dismissing me. It was, I realized, the closest he could come to giving me his thanks. He never called me by name again. The items that were seized from Canada were shipped to various places in Europe, along with meticulous lists of what was included in the shipments, which had been typed by me. From time to time there was a discrepancy. This was usually blamed on a prisoner stealing an item, but more likely it was an SS officer. Daria said she often saw junior officers slip something into their pockets when they thought no one else was looking. When the lists did not match the contents, a phone call would be placed to the Hauptscharführer. It would be up to him to mete out the necessary punishment, even though it had been weeks since the actual looting. One afternoon, when Herr Hauptscharführer was retrieving his lunch from the village, I answered such a phone call. As always, in my precise German, I said, "Herr Hauptscharführer Hauptmann, guten Morgen." The man on the other end of the line introduced himself as Herr Schmidt. "I'm sorry. Herr Hauptscharführer has stepped away from his desk. May I take a message?"
"Yes, you may tell him that the shipment arrived intact. But before I go, I must say, Fräulein, I am having the hardest time placing your accent."
I did not correct him when he called me Fräulein.
"Ich bin Berlinerin," I said.
"Really? Because your diction puts mine to shame," Herr Schmidt replied.
"I attended boarding school in Switzerland," I lied.
"Ah, yes. Perhaps the only place left in Europe that has not been completely ravaged. Vielen Dank, Fräulein. Auf Wiederhören."
I placed the receiver in its cradle, feeling as if I'd been through an interrogation. When I turned around, the Hauptscharführer was back.
"Who was that?"
"Herr Schmidt, confirming the shipment."
"Why did you say you were from Berlin?"
He asked about my accent.
"He was suspicious?"
the Hauptscharführer asked. If he was, did that mean my time as a secretary had run its course? Would I be sent back to Canada, or worse, fall prey to another selection? "I don't think so," I said, my heart racing. "He believed me when I said I'd studied abroad." The Hauptscharführer nodded his agreement.
"Not all would look kindly on your position here."
He sat down, arranging his napkin and slicing into a platter of roast chicken.
"Now, Where did we leave off?
I turned my wooden chair away from the typewriter to face him and opened the leather journal. I had written my requisite 10 pages the night before, but for the first time, I did not think I could share it out loud.
Go on, go on,
the Hauptschaffuhrer urged, waving his fork at me. I cleared my throat.
I had never been so aware of my own breathing or my own pulse.
That was as far as I got before heat flooded my face and I looked into my lap.
What is it? He asked. Is it no good?
I shook my head. He reached across the desk and grabbed the book from me.
Of course, there was no heartbeat to hear, just an emptiness, an understanding that we would never be the same. Did that mean that he hadn't felt the way I did as he moved between...
Suddenly he broke off, blushing just as deeply as I was.
Oh, the Hauptschaffuhrer said. Perhaps this bit is better read silently.
He kissed me as if he were poisoned and I was the antidote. Maybe, I thought, that was true. His teeth nipped at my lip, making it bleed again. When he sucked at the wound, I arched in his embrace, imagining him drinking from me. Afterward, I lay against him, my hands spread across his chest, as if I were measuring the void inside.
I would do anything to have my heart back, Alexander said, if only so that I could give it to you.
You're perfect like this. He buried his face in the curve of my neck.
Anya, he said, I am far from perfect.
There is a magic to intimacy, a world built of sighs and skin that is thicker than brick, stronger than iron. There is only you and him, so impossibly close that nothing can come between, not the enemy, not your allies. In this safe haven, in this hallowed place and time, I could even ask the questions whose answers I feared. Tell me what it was like, I whispered. Your first time. He didn't pretend to misunderstand. He curled onto his side, his body spooned around mine so he wouldn't have to look me in the eye as he spoke.
It felt as if I had been in a desert for months and would die if I couldn't drink. But water, it did nothing. I could consume a lake and it wouldn't have been enough. What I craved was what I could smell through the skin, rich as cognac.
He hesitated.
I had tried to fight the urge. By then I was so hungry, so faint that I could barely stand. I crawled into a barn, wishing for death again. She was carrying a bucket of chicken feed, scattering it in the coop, and I could see her from where I crouched in the rafters. I fell like an archangel, covered her scream with the fabric of my cape, and dragged her into the hayloft where I had been hiding. She begged me for her life, but mine was more important, so I ripped out her throat. I drank her dry and chewed on her bones and peeled away her flesh until there was nothing left, consumed by my hunger. I was disgusted. I couldn't believe what I had become. I tried to clean myself, but her blood left a stain on my hands. I stuck my finger down my throat, but couldn't purge. Still, for the first time in a long time, I wasn't hungry, and because of this, I could finally sleep. The next morning, when her parents came searching for her, calling her name, I awakened. Beside me was all that was left of her. That head, with the thick blonde braid, that round mouth frozen in terror. Those marble eyes staring back at the monster that was now me. I sat beside her, keeping vigil, and I sobbed.
The Hauptschaffuhrer looked up at me, surprised.
The Donestre, he said.
And I nodded, pleased that he had caught the reference to the mythical beast he had told me about.
The second time, it was a prostitute who had stopped to pull up her stockings in an alley. It was easier, or so I told myself, because otherwise I would have had to admit that what I'd done before was wrong. The third time, my first man, a banker who was locking up at the end of the day. There was a teenage girl once who was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and a socialite I heard crying on a hotel balcony. And after that, I stopped caring who they had been. It only mattered that they were there at that moment when I needed them.
Alexander closed his eyes.
It turns out that the more you repeat the same action, no matter how reprehensible, the more you can make an excuse for it in your own mind.
I turned in his arms. How do I know that one day you won't kill me?
He stared at me, hesitating. You don't.
That was the end so far. I had stopped writing at that point so that I could get a few hours of sleep before Appell. The Hauptscharführer set the journal down on the desk between us. His cheeks were still bright pink.
Well, he said.
I could not meet his eye. I had undressed in front of strangers here. I had been stripped in a courtyard by a guard for punishment, and yet I had never felt so exposed.
It's quite interesting, as all that's really described is a kiss. What makes it graphic is the way you talk of Alexander's other exploits.
He tilted his head.
Fascinating to think of violence being just as intimate as love.
When he said that, it surprised me. I could not say that I had written this intentionally, but wasn't it the truth? In both relationships, there were only two people, one who gave and one who sacrificed. It made me think of all those hours we had spent at Gymnasium analyzing the text of a great author. But what did Thomas Mann really mean here? Maybe he had meant nothing. Maybe he just wanted to write a story that nobody could put down.
I take it you have had a beau?
The Hauptscharführer's voice startled me. I could not manage to stammer a response. Finally, I just shook my head.
That makes this section even more impressive, then, the Hauptscharführer replied. If inaccurate.
My eyes flew to meet his. He abruptly looked away, standing, as was his custom after lunch, to leave me the remains while he did a patrol of Canada.
Not the mechanics, he said formally as he buttoned his overcoat. The last bit, when Alexander says it gets easier the second time.
The Hauptscharführer turned away and settled his cap on his head.
It never does.
My typewriter was missing. I stood in front of the spot that the Hauptscharführer had designated as my own little office cubicle, wondering what I had done wrong. Daria had told me that I should not get used to this treatment, and I had shrugged away her concern. When other women sneered or made sarcastic comments about me and the odd friendship I had developed with the Hauptscharführer, I brushed them aside. What did I care what people thought of me, as long as I knew the truth? I was delusional enough to convince myself that as long as my story continued, so would my life. Yet even Scheherazade had run out of stories after 1001 nights. By then, the king, who had spared her from execution each dawn so that she could tell him the rest of the tale later that night, had been made wiser and kinder by the lessons in her stories. He made her his queen. I only wanted the allies to show up before I ran out of plot twists.
You no longer work here,
the Hauptscharführer said flatly. You will report immediately to the hospital.
I blenched. The hospital was an anteroom for the gas chamber. We all knew it. It was why, no matter how sick a girl was, she resisted being taken there. I am not ill, I said. He flicked his glance toward me.
This is not a negotiation.
Mentally, I recounted my work from yesterday. The requisition forms I had filled out, the messages I had taken. I could find nothing that had been done in error. We had talked for a half hour about my book, too, as usual, and it had spurred the Hauptscharführer to tell me of his brief time at university, when he had won an award for his poetry.
Herr Hauptscharführer, I begged, please, give me another chance. Whatever I did wrong, I will fix.
He looked past me toward the open doorway and waved in a young officer who was to escort me out. I do not remember much about my arrival at Block 30. My number was entered into the records by a Jewish prisoner who was manning the front desk. I was brought to a room that was small, crowded, and filthy. Patients lay on top of each other on paper pads, their uniforms stained with bloody diarrhea or vomit. Some had long scars that had been rudimentarily stitched. Rats ran over the bodies of those too exhausted to move. Another prisoner, who must have been assigned here as a worker, carried a stack of linen dressing and followed a nurse as she changed bandages. I tried to get her attention, but she refused to meet my gaze. Probably out of the fear that she was replaceable, like me. The girl beside me was missing an eye. She kept clawing at my arm.
So thirsty, she said over and over in Yiddish.
My temperature was taken and recorded. I want to see a doctor, I cried, my voice rising above the moans of the others. I am healthy. I would tell the doctor that I was fine, that I could go back to work, any kind of work. My worst fear was having to stay here, with these women who looked like broken toys. A woman shoved aside the skeletal body of the girl with the missing eye and sat down on the pad beside me.
Shut up, she hissed. Are you an idiot?
No, but I need to tell them.
If you make enough of a fuss about not being ill, one of the doctors will hear.
Clearly this woman was mad. Because wasn't that exactly what I wanted?
They want the healthy ones, she continued.
I shook my head, completely confused.
I came here because I had a rash on my leg. The doctor who saw me decided the rest of me was sound enough.
She pulled up her dress so that I could see the blistered red burns on her abdomen.
He did this to me with X-rays.
Shuddering, I started to understand. I had to act ill, at least ill enough to escape the notice of the doctors, but not ill enough to be selected by the guards. It seemed like an impossible tightrope to walk.
Some bigwig is coming in from Oranienburg today, she continued. That's what the rumor is. If you know what's good for you, you will not draw attention to yourself. They want to look good for their superiors, if you know what I mean.
I did. It meant that they needed scapegoats. I wondered if word would get to Daria that I had been taken here, if she would try to bribe someone with a treasure from Canada to get me released, if that were even possible. After a while, I lay down on the pad. The girl with the missing eye had a fever. Her body was throwing off waves of heat.
Thirsty, she kept whispering.
I turned away from her, curling into myself. I slipped a leather journal from my dress and started to read my story, from the beginning.
I used this as an anesthetic, trying to see nothing but the words on the page and the world they created. I was aware of a stir in the ward as the nurses raced in, tidying up the room and moving prisoners so that we were not lying on top of each other. I slipped my journal inside my dress again, wondering if the doctor was coming. Instead, a small phalanx of soldiers arrived. They flanked an older man I had never seen before, a highly decorated officer. Judging from the number of underlings surrounding the man and the way the camp officers were practically kissing his boots, he had to be someone very important. A man in a white coat, the infamous doctor, was leading what seemed to be a tour.
"We continue to make progress on methods of mass sterilization through radiation,"
I translated from the German as he spoke. I thought of the girl who had warned me to keep my mouth shut, of the burns on her belly. As the others filed into the small room, I saw the Schutzhaftlagerführer standing among them, his hands clasped behind his back. The high-ranking officer lifted his hand and beckoned him.
"Herr Oberführer, you have a question?"
He pointed to the Jew who had been carrying the bandages for the nurse.
"That one."
The Schutzhaftlagerführer in turn jerked his head at one of the guards accompanying the little battalion. The prisoner was taken from the room.
"It is," the Oberführer intoned, "adequate."
The other officers all relaxed infinitesimally.
"Adequate is not impressive," the Oberführer added. He swept out of the room, and the others followed.
At lunch, I took the broth that I was given. It had a button floating in it, instead of any visible vegetable or meat. I closed my eyes and imagined what the Hauptscharführer was eating. Pork roast, I knew, because I had been the one to fetch him the menu earlier this week from the officers' mess. I had eaten pork only once, at the home of the Szymańskis. I wondered if the Szymańskis were still living in Łódź, if they ever thought of their Jewish friends and what had become of them. Pork roast with green beans and cherry demi-glace. That's what the menu had promised. I did not know what demi-glace meant, but I could taste the cherries bursting on my tongue. I remembered taking a wagon out to the country where Daria's father's factory had been with Josek and the other boys. We had spread a picnic on a checked tablecloth, and Josek had played a game, tossing a cherry into the air and then catching it in his mouth. I showed him how I could tie the stem into a knot with my tongue. I was thinking of this, and of pork roast, and of the picnics we used to have in the summers that were packed by Daria's housekeeper with so much food that we fed the extra to the ducks in the pond. Can you imagine having extra? I was thinking of this and trying so hard to remember the flavor of a walnut and how it differed from a peanut, and considering whether you could lose your sense of taste the way you lost the function of a limb from disuse. I was thinking of this, which was why I did not hear at first what was happening at the entrance to the ward. The Hauptscharführer was yelling at one of the nurses.
"Do you think I have time for this incompetence?" he asked. "Do I need to approach the Schutzhaftlagerführer to solve a problem that should be so far beneath him?"
"No, Herr Hauptscharführer, I am sure we can locate—"
"Never mind."
Spying me, he strode to the pad where I was lying and grabbed me roughly by the wrist.
"You will report to work immediately. You are no longer sick," he pronounced, and he pulled me out of the ward, down the front steps of the hospital, and across the courtyard to the administration buildings. I had to run to keep up with him.
When I arrived, my chair and table and typewriter had been set up again in the same spot. The Hauptstaffführer sat down at his desk. His face was red and he was sweating, although the outside temperature was below freezing. We did not speak of what had happened until the end of the day.
Herr Hauptstaffführer, I asked hesitantly, should I report back here tomorrow morning?
Where else would you go? He asked,
and he did not look up from the list of numbers he was adding.
Daria had her own news for me that night. The beast was dead. The man I'd seen at Block 30 had been the SS Oberführer, Glück's deputy at the Inspectorate of Concentration Camps, and he had also come through the barracks to do an inspection. According to one of the women in our block, who was part of the underground resistance movement at the camp, this deputy had a reputation for plucking Jews out of cushy jobs and sending them to the gas chamber. We had a new Blockälteste who attempted to prove herself to the Aufseherin by making us do jumping jacks for over an hour and beating anyone who tripped or fell in exhaustion. But it was not until a week later, when I was running an errand for the Hauptstaffführer, that I realized it was not just the Blockälteste who had been shot. Nearly every other Jew in a job of privilege, from those who worked, like me, as secretaries, to those who served officers' meals at the mess hall, to the cellist who played at the theater, to the nurse assistant at hospital, was gone. The Hauptstaffführer had not been punishing me by firing me and sending me to the hospital. He had been saving my life.
2 days later, when the camp was thick with snow, we were gathered in the courtyard between the blocks to watch a hanging. Months ago, there had been a revolt by prisoners who worked as Sonderkommandos, disposing of the bodies that came out of the gas chambers. We did not see them, as they were kept separate from the rest of us. From what I heard, the men attacked the guards and blew up one of the crematoria. Prisoners escaped, too, though most of them were recaptured and shot.